Dr. Temple Grandin has spent 30 years fighting for animal welfare reform by looking at livestock handling through the eyes of a cow. She's also internationally famous as a spokesperson on autism, of which she has first-hand experience at the age of 2. When she couldn't speak, doctors thought she had brain damage, as the diagnosis of autism was still very new in those days. Now she's a leader in autism awareness and proof that it doesn't mean a lesser life. In many ways, it can mean an enhanced life. Her acclaimed work in humane livestock handling has been influenced and motivated by her condition, and her contribution to both fields, autism, education and animal welfare, has been so successful that an HBO movie was made about her. Recently, the Professor of Animal Science at Colorado State University was in New Zealand speaking about how to see the world through animal eyes.
When I first started, I got introduced to cattle when I was a teenager, which brings up a really important factor. How do students get interested in different careers? They get exposed to them. And then I started out working with beef cattle in the 70s out in the feed yards in Arizona. Got very interested in the design of facilities. Handling procedures were really bad in the 70s. But I noticed that the animals would stop at a shadow. There might be a coat hanging on a fence, a vehicle parked next to a fence. And if you removed these distractions, they'd go through the race. And I got right down in the races to see what the animals were seeing. And back in the early 70s, that was really a new idea. Also, being a woman in a man's industry in the early 70s was really difficult.
So you started looking at things literally from the perspective of the animal and seeing what would make them balk or make them uncomfortable.
That's the very, very first thing I did. And it was amazing. You'd take out a distraction, or you'd put a light on a dark raceway at a meatworks, and then the cattle would just go right in. And, of course, I had to figure out they were afraid of getting slaughtered. So I'd run back and forth between the meatworks and the large feed yard where they were vaccinating cattle, and I found their behavior was the same in both places.
So you were able to observe what it was that was affecting that behavior. How did we then go from it being your own observations in your own workplace to something that has now become a system for half the cattle processing facilities in the United States? How did you start making people listen to this?
I found that selling people the equipment was easier than getting people to work on the stockmanship. I have found that people often want the magic thing, like the magic new milking shed, more than they want the management side of things. And so I got a lot of places to put equipment in, and I have books where I've written about it, Humane Livestock Handling. I got my website, grandin.com. But getting people to do the management was harder, because people always want the magic thing that's going to fix everything.
You've given some good examples, though, about how you've identified what might be stressing animals that has saved some companies a lot of money. Tell me about the story where there was a flag waving that was distracting or making the animals balk, and they were all set to redesign their whole facility.
Well, sometimes something as simple as moving some vehicles that are parked next to the facility or taking down a flag will greatly improve how the cattle move. It's also really important to stay calm handling cattle. Once they get all stirred up and fearful, it takes about 20 minutes to calm down. So the first secret is to calm down when you're working with animals. And there's a lot of research that's been done in recent years that shows that good stockmanship pays. Some of the first research was done in Australia by Paul Hemsworth, and he found that pigs that were afraid of people were less productive. Stockmanship does matter.
This is a dairy farming country, one of the biggest dairy farm exporters there is. Do you have any observations so far of how we go about things, or what is it that you will be talking about while visiting New Zealand?
Well, we've already been done some talking. I mean, a beautiful green country. When my plane flew into Auckland, it's like no other airport in the world, and what you see when you go in there. And you've got a great thing with your pasture dairying. Nobody else in the world has that, and you need to keep that. Imitating what other countries do probably is not the best thing for you to do. Doing this grass dairying, you can charge a high price for the milk. You need to keep on doing that, because you've got something really special here.
Intensification, is that something that can stress cows in particular? Is that something we need to be careful of if we begin intensifying our industry?
Well, in the U.S. has an intensified industry, but the U.S. is a very different climate. We have extreme winters, very cold weather. We have desert with extreme hot weather. We don't have the kind of land you have here. So in a country like the U.S., to intensify it makes sense. It can be done with good welfare. But in this country, I don't think it makes sense. This is the land of the hobbit. Take advantage of it.
And you believe the U.S. has made mistakes in its industry and some of what it has done to try and supplement or to get a better dollar return or greater level of production on price. You believe the U.S. has made some mistakes?
Well, what we need to be looking at is what is the optimal thing to do. I just recently read a paper written by Nigel Cook in Wisconsin where they've worked really hard to reduce lameness in some of the more intensive dairies. If you work with a cow to make the maximum production, she's got to get the right place to sleep. She's got to have plenty of room to eat and not be fighting over food. Management's got to be just right, and then it works. But where it doesn't work is if management gets sloppy. And there's people in the U.S. that are doing it well. But in this country, you can charge a high price for that.
You've talked about how in poor operations, cows are constantly in the red zone. And is that true of other animal species as well? And I can think of some of the issues we have here, whether it's the battery farming of hens or indeed pigs and sow crates, which has been another debate here. Is there a common theme, which is a stressed animal, you're not going to be getting the best out of that animal?
Well, there's a point where you can overload biology. In fact, I have a paper you can look up online. It's called Animal Welfare and Society Concerns, Finding the Missing Link. Got to type that entire title into Google. Animal Welfare and Society Concerns, Finding the Missing Link. And you can push biology either with genetics, maybe with different feed additives or drugs. And if you do it right, it's okay. But then there's a tipping point where you overload the system. And then it's sort of like a bridge breaking. You've got to make sure that you don't do that. I'm concerned right now that certain lines of beef cattle genetics are starting to repeat some of the leg conformation problems that the pig industry had in the 80s. Where they were just selecting for meat traits and they weren't visually appraising the animals for good feet and legs. And you've got to make sure that cattle don't have problems like post-legged collapsed ankles or crooked claws. And this tends to be more of a problem in the beef breeds. What you have to do is look at what's the optimal thing to do. People sometimes have a hard time stopping.
Intensive breeding, can that be, and I think that might have been what you were alluding to earlier with that practice, can that be a real problem? Breeding for certain traits, but not ensuring enough of a genetic mix.
Well, let's just use an example of the bulldog. And that's not a dairy cow, but it's an example of over-selection for an appearance trait to the point where you have an animal that's difficulty walking, has to have serious sections, has trouble breathing maybe even after it has surgery. And if you go on the internet and you look up on Google Images, Bulldog's Dilemma, you will find a 1938 picture of a bulldog that's a functional dog with some leg and some snout that actually can function. So how do we get into kind of the dysfunctional bulldog we have now? That's what I call bad becoming normal. And it happens slowly. It slowly gets worse and people don't realize it. And then you look at the picture from Bulldog's Dilemma. You go, oh, wow, how did we get there? We've got to make sure that we don't do that with some of our farm animals.
You have had a particular impact when it comes to cows and their well-being, and pigs are the other animal species with which you've got particular knowledge. What are some of the issues we should be thinking of with pigs? There has been the talk about sow crates and isolating sows at that time. A lot of talk about whether they're too confined. What are some of the questions you might ask about that?
Well, sow gestation stalls are going to get phased out. They're getting banned in Europe. A lot of our producers are starting to phase that out because the large supermarkets are demanding it. You know, consumers are demanding it. Those systems will get phased out. And there's a lot of different options for group housing of sows. And I believe in letting the industry innovate. You know, my approach to animal welfare, when I'm making animal welfare guidelines, is let's have certain critical control points we measure. Okay, in dairy, for example, lameness, body condition score. Are they dirty? The udder condition. I've got to make sure we don't have those kinds of problems. Because no matter what kind of great housing you've got or outdoor conditions you've got, if you had 25% lame animals, that's not very good animal welfare. There's certain things that we've got to be measuring. Also, on animal welfare, there's getting to be a lot more interested in positive experiences for animals. I mean, David Malora Massey's talked about that. Now, dairy cows out on pasture grazing, yeah, they're doing what cows want to do. But let's say you put an animal out on a dirt field with hardly any pasture and you let it turn into a bone rack. That's absolutely not acceptable. You know, the first step you have to do is make sure you've prevented suffering and you're not allowing animals to get into a really skinny, low body condition.
You've gone so much further than that, though, in your understanding of animals, and your lecture in New Zealand's entitled Seeing the World Through Animal Eyes. This is where we truly do get to the particular skills that you bring to this. And could you explain a little bit more about the visual when it comes to understanding animal behaviour?
Well, I am a total visual thinker. Everything I think about is a picture. When I was just talking to you about the different systems for raising pigs, I was seeing those systems in my mind. And an animal is a sensory-based thinker. They don't think in words. They're going to think in pictures. The dog's going to think in smell whiffs, audio clips. And I discussed that in one of my books, Animals in Translation, which you can get from Amazon.com, Animals in Translation. You want to understand animals, you've got to get away from verbal language. What is it seeing? What is it hearing? Animals communicate by tone of voice. If you went up to your dog and went, good dog, good dog, he'd be cringing and running away from you. You see, because he'd be reacting to the tone of voice.
This, again, is the great skill that you bring. And I think you've said if you are trying to understand autism, animals or art, you've got to think in pictures, not verbal language.
Well, also on the autism front, and on a lot of kids that are in, you know, dyslexic or maybe they're labeled ADHD, there's different kinds of minds. They're often good at one thing, bad at something else. I'm an extreme visual thinker, had a horrible time with algebra. Oftentimes, my kind of mind can do geometry really well. Another kind of kid is the mathematician mind, thinks in patterns, is going to be good at computer programming. Sometimes those kids have trouble with reading. Other people are much more word-oriented. In fact, I have a 2010 TED Talk called Different Kinds of Minds. It's on the TED website or on YouTube, where I talk about, let's work on figuring out careers for students with different kinds of minds where they can be good at it. Visual thinkers like me are really good at design work, graphic design, all kinds of drawing things, working with animals, architecture. The mathematical minds are your engineers, your computer programmers. Half of Silicon Valley's got a little bit of autism. You see, a little bit of the autism trait gives you Einstein. He had no language till age 3. It gives you Silicon Valley computer engineers. It gives you Mozart and great artists. Too much of the trait, and you have a child that ends up remaining nonverbal.
We just haven't, till now, understood enough, have we? And we're still learning. I think you made the point also that for you especially, you think in details. And even if we looked at a word or a sentence, I might see the whole word or sentence, you would see the part of it. It doesn't help you necessarily become a reader, but that kind of ability to see in details helps you all solve all sorts of problems.
Well, because everything is specific examples. You see, the way a lot of people think is get a big hypothesis, we're going to fix education with some latest big educational theory that doesn't work half the time. I'm a bottom-up thinker. This is more like the science of epidemiology. I just have been at the New Zealand Veterinary Congress, and I went to some of the public health talks, and they talk about when there's a disease outbreak. Well, it happens over here, then they look over here, and they piece together the pieces. This is a field of epidemiology. That's more how I think. I like piece together the puzzle.
You see also, I think you've described, you see visually, but you see very specific pictures as well. I think you've compared it to like Google for pictures. So there'll be one visual picture, then another, and that is the way you visually experience things.
That's right. And when I was young, I thought everybody thought in pictures. I didn't know that thinking in pictures was something different. And it's been a long road for me learning how different people think differently.
You've spoken of that early life, and I don't think you didn't talk until you were 3.5 years old, and communicating your frustration instead through other behaviours. And have we got better at understanding different ways of thinking, different minds, and not talking about them and approaching them always in the negative? Have things got better from what you went through?
Well, I had a really, my mother was always getting me to do new things. There was a lot of emphasis on learning manners. My ability in art was always encouraged, but I was encouraged to do lots of different art. And then I had great mentors like my science teacher and my aunt out at the ranch. And there were some good people in the cattle industry. The HBO movie shows some people doing some bad things, but there also were some good people that actually seeked me out. We've got to build on what the kid is good at. And I don't want to see, you see a fully verbal smart kid getting too into, well, I've got this handicap. Well, Einstein had the same handicap. He did a lot of really good things. Take the thing that you're good at and build on it. Another problem I'm seeing with a lot of these kids that get these different labels is they're not learning working skills. And that needs to start when they're like 12, 13 years old. Volunteer jobs, jobs with a community center or with a church. They've got to learn how to do tasks for other people outside the home. And if you're interested in this, I do have some other books. I have a book called The Way I See It. It's a whole lot of little short articles and really useful for parents and teachers of young children that have been labeled with autism.
Why is it important to be doing things outside of the home and making those connections? Just explain a bit more. Is that because for some reason it doesn't happen because it's perceived not to be helpful? Or does it have a particular benefit for a child with autism?
Well, it has a benefit for all kids, but there's a tendency sometimes to kind of coddle and overprotect these kids. Oh, Tommy's got autism. We'll order his hamburger for him. I go, no, he's got to learn how to go up to the counter and order it for himself. They've got to learn these basic skills. And I worked with a lot of people in skilled trades when we were building facilities at big plants like Cargill and Tyson that I know were on the autism spectrum. But they took welding in high school. And they got interested in that. Or they got introduced to farming. I know people that work with cattle that I'm sure are on the autism spectrum. And they're very successful.
It's important, too, for the education system to understand how people see the world, literally, and how they learn. Because you've made the point that we've almost got to the point of medicalizing. We're talking about a continuum, right? But almost to a point of medicalizing, but also in the education system, we're becoming very abstract in the way...
This is the problem. I think it's a huge, gigantic, big problem. And one of the things I'm getting interested in is successful people with unconventional career paths. And would these people be able to get through the system today? I looked up a lot of stuff on Jane Goodall. She had a 2-year secretarial degree. And then got a chance to go to Africa and was hired originally as a secretary for Dr. Leakey. Then he put her out there observing chimpanzees. And she also had exposure to a lot of animal books as a child. And Jane Goodall got her PhD without having any undergraduate degree. Would that happen today? I'm getting very concerned that our educational system is screening out too many innovative thinkers.
As you say, it's the Silicon Valleys, any number of industries that are important and to the fore today need people with these kinds of thinking skills, innate thinking skills, or just the way they view the world.
The other thing I want to warn you, there are certain kids with diagnoses where it's very easy for them to turn into video game addicts. And we've got to get this under control. And I know I've been called an old fogey by some of the video game players, but these kids are not having good outcomes. They're playing games for 8 hours a day, not getting jobs. That has to be limited. And I'm one of the ones that if video games have been around when I was a little kid, I could have become an addict. And what little bit of video game playing I've done, I'm going, wait a minute, this is crack cocaine. I'm not touching it. None of that stuff's going to be on my phone.
It's interesting. The innovations that have come out of this journey. I think it was your aunt's cattle squeeze shoot that was when you first began to make the link link with animals and perhaps the way the animals view the world and you view the world. Can you explain a bit more?
When I got into puberty, I started having horrible anxiety attacks, constant panic attacks. That is now controlled with a low dose of antidepressant medication. And when you use antidepressant medication for anxiety, the mistake that doctors make is follow the label and use the doses for depression, which are too high. And then you're going to get agitation and insomnia. And if you want to read about the My Squeeze Machine and problems with anxiety, I have another book, Thinking in Pictures. It's available on Amazon, too. Okay, so I was out at my aunt's ranch, and I was watching cattle go in the squeeze chute for their vaccinations. And, of course, a lot of the cattle in Arizona are not as tame as some of the cattle here, so they have a squeeze sides to hold them. And I noticed that some of the cattle kind of relaxed. So then I went and tried out the squeeze chute, and the pressure calmed me down. So then I built a device I could get into that applied pressure. You know, there's a lot of people that find pressure is calming. And then, of course, that got me interested in the cattle.
It's amazing how much you have inspired. And on that point, how much convincing and how determined did you have to be when you were beginning to improve and help people improve the livestock management? As we said, now half the facilities in the country have learned from what you've done. But was it difficult to change minds at first?
Well, the most difficult thing for me back in the early 70s when I started was being a woman in a man's world. That was 10 times more difficult than the autism part of it. The other thing I learned was to sell my work. People didn't want to take me seriously. Then I'd take my drawings out, show them my drawings, show them pictures of jobs, and they go, you may be weird, but, you know, you seem to know about things. And then I started, you know, writing about handling animals. And I developed a piece of equipment in the mid-80s and the early 90s called the Center Track Conveyor Restrainer System. If you want to see how that works, you can look up Beef Plant Video Tour with Temple Grandin. And it's in all the large North American large meat plants, both in Canada and the U.S. About half of the North American cattle are handled in that piece of equipment.
There is, of course, the HBO movie of your life, which came out in 2010, starring Claire Danes. And what did you make of that? Did they get you about right, do you think, in that movie?
They did absolutely fantastic with it. I loved the fact that they showed my visual thinking. They showed all my projects. All the projects I designed that were shown in the movie, I actually did those projects. My actual drawings were in the movie. That really turned me on. I liked the way it showed all the career stuff because I want to see these kids that are different get out and get into interesting careers.
What more do we have to learn about how to observe better, encourage better, speak better, and allow everybody to be the best they can be? What have we learned over these many, many years since your experience as a child, and what else do we still need to learn?
Well, I get asked all the time, well, how do we work with different kinds of minds? The first thing you have to understand is that people do think differently, and people that get very abstract tend to be highly, highly verbal. But they also tend to be more organized than us visual thinkers that are very good at association. That's the reason why in a number of my books I have a co-author. Because what the co-author did is help me with the organization. You know, I used to say that the Catherine, my co-author, she built the tree, you know, like the Christmas tree, and then I decorate it with all the ornaments. But associative thinkers are not that good in linear structure. Let's take another example of different kinds of minds. Steve Jobs was probably on the spectrum. He was an artist that designed the easy-to-use interface on the iPhone. Then the engineers had to figure out how to make that interface work. That's an example of the different kinds of minds working together. The Fukushima nuclear power plant disaster is another example where we need a visual thinker. They made a visual thinking mistake so basic, it blew my mind when I found out why those reactors burned up. All I need to know about a nuclear reactor is if the emergency pump doesn't work when I need it, I'm in a lot of trouble. And they put the generators and the emergency cooling pump in a non-waterproof basement. So when the tsunami came in there, it just drowned all their emergency equipment. There's no way I would have made that mistake. I would have bought watertight doors because I would have seen the water coming in there and filling up the basement. And what I've learned with the mathematical mind, they don't see it. because I have a slide that I show, and I showed it to a whole bunch of mathematicians at Fermilab. It's a picture of a steer looking at a sunbeam. And in that, amongst all those mathematicians, nobody saw it. When I show that same slide to a bunch of children, half the room will see it.
We have all kinds of different minds, and maybe we are getting better at understanding that, but we all have the same kind of heart, don't we? And how hard has the journey been for you sometimes when people just have not understood? And again, are we getting better at recognizing and understanding difference?
Well, I think we are. I think things are definitely getting better. But basically, what we got to do is look at a kid and see what he can do. You know, how do you figure out what kind of mind a kid's got? It will usually show up around 7, 8, 9 years old. Artists will be drawing. And then what you want to do is encourage them to draw lots of different things, because when they grow up, they've got to learn how to do art for other people. Kid good in math. There's a lot of kids good in math. They're 8 years old, bored in school. Don't have them do baby math. Let them do more advanced math. Get them the more advanced math books. I'm not suggesting taking a little kid and put them in high school, but just bring the more advanced stuff into the elementary school class. And he may need special education and tutoring and reading. That tends to be the pattern. Maybe high school math and need some tutoring for reading. Kid good at writing. Encourage him to be writing lots of different things. Teach the mathematicians coding and computer programming. Those classes are free online. Khan Academy. K-H-A-N, like Genghis Khan Academy. The classes are free.
Temple Grandin.